ready to call 97-0686. Prosser versus Luke. And first attorney will be Jason W. Whitley. Mr. Whitley, whenever you're ready. Represent Mr. Luke and the Cedarburg Mutual Insurance Company. Is that correct?
I represent Robert Prosser.
All right. Okay, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Jason Whitley. I represent Robert Prosser, the petitioner in this matter. It seems to me, first of all, that this case could become very simple if this court simply agreed with the trial court and with Mr. Prosser's position that the offer to settle is not ambiguous. The plain language of that offer to settle simply stated that Mr. Prosser would dismiss the pending litigation and the defendants in the singular possessive noun liability attendant to said litigation. The offer was made specifically to Cedarburg, not to Cedarburg and Luke. It was provided to Cedarburg's attorney, who was then Levy, I believe. At the time that the offer was made, Luke was represented by his independent counsel. At least he had a guardian ad litem. It was not directed to that guardian ad litem or his independent counsel. The offer was, as I said, it was to one defendant. The word defendant is singular and possessive. And to indicate or to assume that offer somehow applied to both defendants, I just don't understand how that can be taken from the language in that offer. It's a grammatically correct sentence, and nobody at any time through the 4 or 5 years of this litigation ever indicated that they believed there was some ambiguity as to who would be released here. In fact, when we got the decision from the appellate court, the most recent decision from the appellate court, I was very surprised to find that they had, in fact, ruled based upon some sort of ambiguity. There were many other issues that seemed more compelling for the court to touch on. And when Cedarburg cross-appealed with that last appeal, that was the first time that we heard that somehow this offer was ambiguous. In November of 1995, Cedarburg wrote a letter to Prosser's attorneys, and that's at 23 of their brief in the supplemental appendix. They're offering to pay $100,000, which is their policy limits, in exchange to dismiss Luke and Cedarburg. Never once, and they go through and they indicate why they don't believe our offer was valid at the time that it was made.
Counsel, can you tell me what you believe your offer unambiguously did or offered? Was it to release just Cedarburg, or was it to release or to dismiss the entire pending litigation against everybody?
It was to dismiss just Cedarburg in exchange for $99,750 plus costs.
Well, then what's the meaning of dismiss this pending litigation?
This pending litigation needs to be read with the rest of the sentence, and the defendant's singular possessive liability attendant to said litigation.
Well, if you dismiss pending litigation, aren't you dismissing it against Luke and Cedarburg?
The way I have always understood that sentence to be, the way that I think it should be read, is that this pending litigation refers to the litigation pending against Cedarburg, because that's what the rest of the sentence says. The liability attendant.
What did the caption say? Didn't the caption say Prosser versus Luke and Cedarburg?
That's correct, and that's why the offer was addressed solely to Cedarburg. And that is why there are two defendants, and the offer speaks to the defendants in the singular possessive noun, Cedarburg.
Did you intend, after this offer of settlement was presented, to still hold Luke liable or any award?
Well, there was some question as to whether his conduct was intentional or not. so it was something that would not be discharged in bankruptcy if it was found to be intentional.
Had the court found that it wasn't intentional?
The jury found that it was not intentional. The court said it was. It was reversed on appeal. But at the time the offer was made, there wasn't enough information available to know whether we wanted to dismiss Luke also, and certainly we had no obligation to dismiss Luke if we were dismissing Cedarburg.
Of course, it's Cedarburg's duty to protect their insured. Do you agree with that principle?
It's their duty to provide their insured with the defense up to the limits of liability in their policy. And their policy explicitly states that once they pay the policy maximums, their duty to defend and their duty to indemnify is canceled or is completed. And they highlighted that again in this November 30th letter. Cedarburg says, Cedarburg Mutual contender policy limits to the court and be relieved of further duty to indemnify. They will exercise that option if necessary. So they knew back in 1995 that once they paid their policy limits, they were done.
Well, does further duty to indemnify mean no longer having a duty to defend?
Well, no, it doesn't. They're separate. There's a duty to defend and a duty to indemnify.
Isn't there an issue here whether or not there remained a duty to defend? I understood that to be an issue. And tying in that case that we had requiring the highlighting of duty to defend. And
sure, I can respond to that in two ways. First of all, this letter that Cedarburg wrote says, relieved of further duty to defend or indemnify. So that's both. And they're also quoting language from their policy, and they said that they intend to do that. The case that Cedarburg relies on stating that it has to be highlighted, at least this continuing duty to defend or the termination of the duty to defend needs to be highlighted. In that case, the policy was a renewal. The first policy, there was no such language. They renewed the policy, then there was a binder of some sort, but the insured had never received a copy of the policy with the language stating that once the insurance company pays its limits, it no longer has a duty to defend. So I don't think that that applies to Cedarburg here. And certainly, without a doubt, had Cedarburg paid the $100,000, they would not have had any doubt in their mind whether they still owed a duty to defend Luke. They would have been gone, as they indicated in that November letter.
Mr. Whitley, doesn't the insurance company, doesn't Cedarburg here also have to be concerned with the issue of bad faith? If they were to settle this matter for the amount that you asked in the offer of settlement and not be concerned about Luke, not be concerned about their insured, aren't they dealing with then the potential for a bad faith claim?
They may be, and I'm sure they probably are concerned about that, but the standard for whether an offer to settle is valid is whether the offeree has an opportunity to evaluate its exposure to the plaintiff, not to its insured or claims for contribution or third party or cross claims. It's to the plaintiff.
Well, let's assume for a minute that the Court of Appeals is right, that this is an ambiguous offer of settlement. Now you've got a situation where it seems to me that you've got to be able to take that further and look at the situation in terms of what you're now claiming. And I understand what you're claiming is that in order to clarify an ambiguous offer of settlement, the duty is on the offeree rather than the offeror. What is your authority for that?
That was something that was thought of by the Court of Appeals. I agree that it would be useful if there were a duty to clarify any perceived ambiguity, especially in a case such as this, where they sat on the offer to settle for 4 years before raising any indication that they thought that this was ambiguous. But the Court of Appeals came up with that, and this court did touch on that briefly in DeMars, and it said that...
Well, doesn't this court in DeMars seem to take the opposite approach?
It does. And I think that at the time, that was early on before there were 95 more appeals with regard to this statute in the interpretation of 80701. And since that time, perhaps this court would take a different position. Certainly the Court of Appeals believes that this court should impose some sort of a requirement on an offeree to clarify.
Has any state ever said that? Do we have any case law supporting that position?
Not that I'm aware of. There's, and even, I mean, I admit under the statute that there is no indication that it would be the obligation of the person making the offer to, or the person receiving the offer to clarify anything that they believe to be ambiguous. But this case, this statute has been interpreted so many times, and it seems, reading the mountain of decisions with regard to 80701, that it really is not very close to what originally said anyway. So one further interpretation to require an offeree to clarify perceived ambiguity, I don't think would be completely out of line with the way that it has progressed since 1975.
Counsel, you touched upon something that to me is an issue that's bothersome. The Court of Appeals said it was ambiguous. Then the Court of Appeals said, essentially, the ambiguity is material. In other words, it affected their ability to assess their exposure or liability. Now, this is the point. In response to Justice Crook's question, you said that the test in Wisconsin is that it affects their ability to assess their liability vis-a-vis the plaintiff.
Exactly.
That's your position, that's what Wisconsin law is, and that any, the plaintiff in the action here, and that any concern about bad faith is not vis-a-vis the plaintiff, but vis-a-vis their policyholder.
Correct.
I think it's your position that under the law in Wisconsin, in order for it to be material in affecting their ability to assess their liability, it has to be only to the plaintiff and not concerned about policyholder liability. Is that your position?
That is my position.
And what case, and I know there are cases, but what case authority are you relying on to say that bad faith is not within this universe of concern under our law?
Well, the case in regard to bad faith would be blank v. USSAA. And that case states that an insurer who pays policy limits and then walks away does not continue to defend their insured is not subject to a bad faith claim. In Wilbur, the court said that's the case that said that the duty is upon the plaintiff to enable the defendant or the offeree to evaluate its exposure vis-a-vis the plaintiff only, not these extraneous types of connections with the offeree. And I think I can, and the way this evaluation has come about is that the offeree has to be able to determine the amount of money necessary to settle the claim with the plaintiff. And the Court of Appeals said that this ambiguity with regard to who it's dismissing somehow affected Cedarburg's ability to determine how much money it would take for them to settle. There is no way that this ambiguity about who was being dismissed affected their ability to determine that $99,750 plus costs was the amount it would take to be done. Now, maybe they didn't know if Luke would be in or out, but they certainly knew how much money it would take for them to be out. Now then, the Court of Appeals went on to state that while it was also unable to evaluate its collateral exposure vis-a-vis its insured, Cedarburg also makes a similar argument that its collateral exposure with regard to whether it owes a continued duty to defend and the possible bad faith. But I want to answer that issue by posing a hypothetical question. What if it was perfectly clear in Prosser's offer that Luke was in and Cedarburg was out, and there is absolutely no question that Luke would continue to be a defendant, therefore there is no ambiguity? Cedarburg still faces the dilemma of whether they owe a duty to defend, and they still face the dilemma of whether they're subject to bad faith for getting out and leaving their defendant in there. So when you were commenting on the ambiguity being material. In this instance, the ambiguity is not material because the dilemma or the problem posed by the court and complained of by Cederberg would still be there if the offer were perfectly clear that Luke stayed in the litigation. They would still face the dilemma under their policy of whether they had to defend, and they would still face the dilemma of whether they're going to be sued by Luke for bad faith for leaving him in the litigation. So with that, and that gets back to the standard of, you know, the standard has been clear throughout all this 80701 litigation that the duty or the ability to assess one's liability to the plaintiff or the offeror is the only question. And that question is in terms of how much money will it take. Both of those questions in Prosser's offer, ambiguity or no ambiguity, can be answered clearly. And therefore, I don't see that it's appropriate that the offer be deemed to be invalid, because everything that essentially my point is that ambiguity or no ambiguity, it's irrelevant. Cederberg is in the same position, and they would be no better off had there not been an ambiguity.
Is the element that it has to materially affect their ability to assess their liability in relation to someone, is that an element of the analysis? In other words, you first look at whether or not it's ambiguous, and then you look at whether or not the ambiguity makes any difference. Is that your position, or am I missing?
Certainly, I think that that is an appropriate or a proper way to look at it. If there's no ambiguity, then they're not going to have any problem addressing their liability.
But if there is an ambiguity and it makes no difference, I mean, it's not an ambiguity of consequence, then what? For instance, here's a hypothetical. Same facts as we have here. Liquidated damages of about $600,000 in the fire, okay? But the policy limits are $1 million. And they offer to settle, and there's an offer of settlement for $600,000, but other than that, the language is still the same. This litigation, apostrophe S for defendants. Conceivably, you would have then a ambiguity as found by the Court of Appeals, same language, different. But it would be of no consequence because the policy limits work. $1 million with liquidated damages of $600,000.
That would be just like the Testa case, where the offer to settle was for less than policy limits, and both the insured and the insurer, I guess it would not be exactly like that, because in Testa both parties were dismissed. In your situation, I think the ambiguity in your hypothetical might be material, because if Cederberg were to get out for less than policy limits, it would still have a duty to defend under the language of its own policy, and therefore would be very interested in whether Luke, with a $1 million policy, is going to be dismissed or not. But here...
Well, I guess that's why I said liquidated specific damages of $600,000. There was no claim beyond the $600,000 liquidated damages, and it was a sum certain.
Then it would be the same situation. If the damages were $600,000 only, they're still getting out for under policy limits, and Luke would be faced with no, you know, further liability whatsoever. They would be in a better position in your hypothetical than they would be in this.
And from your point of view, then, and say, okay, there's an ambiguity, but the ambiguity in my hypothetical makes no difference, and therefore it should be considered a valid offer to settle that brings along the double costs and the interests.
Absolutely.
I just want to make sure I understand.
Yes. If the ambiguity does not affect their ability to evaluate their exposure to the offeror, and it doesn't affect their ability to determine how much money it would take to settle, then it's not material and it makes no difference. And that's how all of these cases finding invalid offers have been interpreted up until this Court of Appeals decision. This Court of Appeals decision, I think, took this Q case and said that any ambiguity regardless of its materiality, makes the offer invalid. That's the first time that's ever happened. And
it's one of those per se ambiguity cases, huh?
Exactly. Now, with regard to the initial offer that Cedarburg turned down, and this, I guess, gets to the question of whether they should have a duty to clarify something, they never intended to settle this case, and that was clear from the outset. They wanted to contest coverage. And subsequently, Cedarburg has made arguments in regard to their full, fair evaluation of the offer that somehow their inability to determine whether they did in fact owe coverage way back when the offer was made affected their ability to evaluate the claim. That has never been addressed as a standard under any case, and I just wanted to point that out. It's an argument they made in their briefs. One last thing here, this Knock case was a situation where a plaintiff made an offer to the insured for $15,000 and the insurer for policy limits. And they said, upon payment of the above amounts, the entire action shall be dismissed as to defendants and as to defendants insured and insurer. Well, the insurance company paid its policy limits, but the defendant did not pay the additional $15,000. And so under that offer, if you compare that to Prosser's offer, there would be an ambiguity in Knock. But the court said, well, that ambiguity isn't essentially, they said it's not material here, because both parties knew how much they needed to pay to get out of the litigation, and because the insurance company paid its policy limits, it can go, even though there was some ambiguity in the offer as to whether they would in fact be allowed to be dismissed without also the insured paying $15,000. The two were tied together, one paid and one didn't. And so there is some precedent as to material versus immaterial ambiguities within that case. If there's no other questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Tim Doyle from Rice Lake. I represent Richard Luick and Cedarburg Mutual. Lest there be any confusion, when this action started, I represented only Richard Luick. He's a young man, a teenager, who started a fire that burned down a warehouse full of old telephones. That's the subject of this litigation. There was an intense disagreement about insurance coverage for Richard's act. It ended up decided one way by the jury, decided a different way by the trial judge, and decided back with the jury by the District 3 Court of Appeals. And then this court declined to take review of that coverage issue. After coverage was fully resolved, I then became counsel of record for both Richard Luick and Cedarburg. At that point, it was clear then that Cedarburg owed coverage and that the parties were united in interest, and therefore I represent both of them before you today. There is no provision in our common law for assessing prejudgment interest on unliquidated claims. This statute that we're dealing with, 807.01, creates an exception to that general rule of law, but as such exception, it requires a very narrow and strict interpretation and application. The burden clearly with regard to assessing sanctions on the basis of an offer of settlement, the burden clearly lies with the party drafting that offer to make it specific and clear so that the party to whom it's offered knows what the deal is, how much money will it take, and who's getting out if I pay that sum of money. The DeMars case that this court decided clearly states that the defendant's only duty is to accept the offer in writing within 10 days after its receipt if so desired. It would be contrary to the clear intent of the statute to allow the plaintiff to serve a settlement offer which is less than specific and then require the defendant to ask the plaintiff to restate the offer with more specificity. This offer is poorly drafted. It is not specific. It is difficult to know what it means.
How would you have drafted it, counsel?
I would have made it much shorter, Your Honor. I would have stated in there whether it was my intent to release both the insurance company and the insured. I would have stated the same amount of money throughout as opposed to this one, which in the second paragraph states that we'll dismiss for $99,750 cash plus the actual cost of this action, an unknown amount. And at the end of the offer, it states that Robert Prosser will accept the sum of $99,750 in settlement. I don't know. I didn't know then. I don't know now what actual cost means. It's something different from taxable costs. Those are spelled out in Section 814 for us. Actual costs in my lexicon are actual costs, including actual attorney's fees. In those cases where I've heard the term discussed, I took a look and couldn't find any case law authority for a definition of that term. But those are two different amounts, clearly, the first being unknown. And the biggest problem perhaps being that we don't know whether this pending litigation means against both Lewick and the insurance carrier or just Cedarburg.
Let's suppose that it was for a fixed amount of, let's just pick $99,000 plus, or let's take $100,000, and let's suppose it was drafted the way you wanted it drafted, namely, it said that it will be dismissed only against Cedarburg, not against anyone else.
Couldn't do it. Couldn't accept it under the existing law at that time.
You can't accept it. Why not?
Because the DeMars case tells us that we have an obligation to our insured under these circumstances. The Q case tells us...
What's your obligation to the insured?
To find out if we're going to get him out for the same amount of money and to keep in mind our duty to defend him and indemnify him under the policy. That blank case wasn't decided until several years after this offer was made.
So your position is that even if this offer was just against Cedarburg, which Foster says it is, you couldn't take it, and then if you didn't take it, you don't think you should pay pre-verdict interest or double cost. Is that your position?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Well, you could have put in the $100,000 in court and or to the plaintiff and still gone on to defend.
We could have done that, except in this particular case, Your Honor, we were in the throes of a coverage dispute. In fact, the trial judge said there was no coverage for this fire at all. We would have, at that stage at least, we would have felt unhappy about paying $100,000 in on a case where the trial judge said there was no coverage.
No, but isn't that the whole point? So that puts the risk of interest and costs on you. I mean, their risk is to take $100,000 from you, and you either accept it or not. I mean, you don't accept it, and you have a perfectly valid reason for continuing on. That's okay. But the statute says then you pay pre-verdict interest and double costs. It's to encourage you if there's a shadow of a doubt.
Well, those sanctions are always an encouragement to litigants to,
right,
to do that.
Right.
On the other hand, they shouldn't be they should be judiciously imposed. I think there's a case that's come up, Oliver, where Heritage, I think, was the insurance company, and they got an offer from the plaintiff, and they didn't accept it. But then as soon as they were able to get some discovery in the case and find out that maybe they did owe their policy limit, they tendered it, and the court in Oliver said, hey, that makes sense. If plaintiff serves an offer right out of the gate before the defendant knows much about the case, and so they don't accept the offer, but later on when they do find out enough to evaluate their true exposure, they then tender the policy, then you shouldn't impose the sanctions. And that's exactly what Cedarburg did here. Within 2 weeks after the coverage issue being resolved by this court's denial of review, the policy was on the table, plus costs on appeal.
Well, but didn't you still have the same problem about not releasing your insured?
Well, not at that point, because coverage had been resolved, and we intended to get, and did get, a judgment and effectively a release of both the company and the insured.
For how much?
For the $100,000.
So, that's my last question. Suppose that this offer was to release the insured and your insurance company for $100,000. You still had a coverage problem from your standpoint. So you reject the offer. All right. Then you discover, well, the jury brings in a verdict of $100,000 or more. Should you pay pre-verdict interest and double costs?
If the offer was directed to just the insurance company or
both of you? But you still are worried that you have a coverage problem. You think maybe you don't have coverage, so you refuse the offer.
I think if that offer was clear that it intended to release everybody, and we did not accept it, and after all the dust settled on the coverage issue, and after a trial of the underlying action, which there never was, because there didn't need to be one, I think if the offer were sufficient and clear in that regard, I think the statute would operate and we would owe the sanction.
Even though there was a coverage question?
That's a tough one. I don't know the answer to that one.
It seems to be contrary to what you told us about the Oliver case. That's why I'm pressing you on it. Seems to be contrary. You said in Oliver there was uncertainty, so you didn't accept it, but when you clarified the problem, you then tendered it, and as you explained the case, then you shouldn't have sanctions imposed. I don't understand that, really.
Fair enough. It's two different analyses. There was no issue in Oliver about the effectiveness of the language of the offer. The issue there was the insurance carrier's tardy response beyond the 10 days when they found out some additional facts and then determined that their exposure was such that they ought to pay. I think Oliver applies here. If it were an otherwise effective offer, then I think Oliver applies and Cedarburg is to be forgiven for not paying until they knew the answer to the coverage issue. The first inquiry is whether it's an effective offer, and I don't think it is. Mr. Whitley's has taken a position today that it was clearly just addressed to the insurance company. I don't think it's clear in that regard, and we didn't, when it was sent, it was unclear and unknown.
Counsel, let me go at this a different way. Forget all this, all this other stuff. Let's just assume a case where there's an offer to settle that reads just like this, and you take the position that it's ambiguous. And I take it that the reason you think it's ambiguous is because you're not sure who it is intended to get out of this lawsuit, whether it's Cedarburg or whether both. Correct?
Correct.
That's why this statement's ambiguous. And therefore, you take the position that the insurance company has no duty to clarify the ambiguity. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's our reading of the law.
Okay. Doesn't the insurance company have a duty to clarify the ambiguity to its own insurer? Because if, in fact, the offer was made to get the insured out, as well as you, as well as Cedarburg, doesn't the insured have a right to know that? Because otherwise it might be exposed to $1 million worth of liability.
Sure. At that point, then you've got Cedarburg attempting to interpret the plaintiff's offer.
Picking up the phone and calling up Mr. Whitley, saying, "Are you going to let our insured out as well as us? Because if you are, I've got to know that. Because my insured doesn't. I've got a duty to my insured not to leave him exposed to an awful lot of liability."
True enough. It's just that wasn't their obligation under DeMars or under Q.
First, those are court of appeals cases, right?
DeMars is a decision of this court.
Oh, okay. There were two cases, Strange or something, that was cited in the court of appeals opinion. Well, let's not get into that. Well, I'm perplexed as to, since you answered my question, that yeah, the insurance company certainly has a duty to the insured to clarify this, because it may well be relieving the insured of an awful lot of liability, then why shouldn't it have a duty to clarify, just in general, when you get something like this?
That I suspect that one reason this court took review is the at least implication or suggestion in the Court of Appeals decision that perhaps different rules should be...
They pointed to, you know, they were essentially making the argument that the intent, the duty of the court is to effectuate the intent of the legislature, and the intent of the legislature is to speed up resolution of, you know, all... We know all those arguments. But I'm looking at it from a different angle, that you also have a duty, it seems to me, to clarify for the insurer.
Well, of course, at that time... That offer was never sent to the insured. It was only sent to then counsel for the insurance company.
Ah, and that insurance company didn't represent the insured?
Well, as to the coverage issue, there was separate counsel, that being me.
Then why would there be confusion if only one counsel got it and it was counsel for the insurance company?
Well, I think the confusion arises from the language of the offer.
No, but you didn't send it to the other guy, which would mean it didn't affect him. I mean, I will say for the moment that you do have an ambiguity. Litigation can be read to mean litigation against one defendant or two defendants or three or whatever number there are. But the singular defendant would need you to believe it only meant the insurance company here. So on the face of it, it looks like an ambiguity. Now, only one counsel, only one party got this offer, not the other party. Therefore, that seems to clarify the ambiguity that it was only intended to that party because you didn't make the offer to the other party.
In other words, I think what the chief is saying, or I was saying, or getting at it, either the offer was clarified because it was sent to one, or you had a duty to clarify because you got a duty to your insured.
That's right, because if that insured got the offer, that insured might say, hey, pay up because I want out because I'm subject to more liability, which is just as bad, which is point, and that there was a flaw here in your not advising the insured, even if you didn't have to call the plaintiff here and say, hey, I don't understand your offer, you had to at least tell the insured. Yes.
And in order to tell the insured, you would have to clarify it from Mr. Whitley as to who he, as to what he was.
Right, and DeMars says and Q says that the burden is on the person who drafted it to make it clear.
Well, what about Town Realty versus Zurch? We decided that case 2 years ago. It dealt with a tender of defense, if I recall correctly, and the insured tendered to the insurance company defense, arguably. It was questionable if it was really a tender. That was the whole issue. Was it really a tender? The issue in that case was, who has the responsibility to clarify whether or not this is a tender of the defense? And we came, and this court said, the insurance company has the responsibility to clarify whether or not this is a valid tender of defense. How does that apply in this case at all? Town Realty versus Zurich Insurance Company.
The difference, perhaps, is that here you've got the plaintiff who's seeking imposition of significant sanctions. If you look at the long pendency of this case, and wants that extra money, and at least up to this point, the burden clearly has been on him, the plaintiff, to make it clear, to make it understandable to the person receiving it as to exactly what it's going to cost and exactly who's going to be released. And that's, you know, those are the rules that were in place at the time the offer was made. Those are the rules by which Cedarburg thought that they were playing. This one, of course, is made more complex by the fact that the coverage issue was up in the air. Cedarburg was providing their insured with a defense on the merits of the case, and at the same time, the coverage issue was being ironed out in the trial court and in the Court of Appeals.
Counsel, how can you said that the case law says you don't have to contact the insurance company. I haven't read that case, so you may well be right, but if that's the case, then it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me, because how else can you clarify what this offer meant and determine whether or not it does let the insured off the hook without contacting Mr. Whitley? You can't do it yourself.
Right. Except that that's not where the burden lies, Your Honor, and under the...
But your burden is to protect the interests of your insured.
Certainly. Certainly.
And how do you protect the interests of your insured without contacting Whitley? I'm not trying to track me.
Yeah,
just,
I know. You know, the bottom line is that without coverage being resolved, Cedarbrook couldn't know whether it was appropriate to accept that offer.
That's the point. Upon whom should the burden of not being sure rest? With the plaintiff who makes an offer, or with you? I mean, I think that's the issue. And
I thought I understood you to say that from the outset you represented Mr. Luke and then subsequently represented the insurance company?
Is that after the coverage issue was resolved? That's correct.
So you were only representing Mr. Luke at the time the offer was made?
That is correct.
Were you notified by the insurance company that the offer had been made?
You know, I can't tell you that. I know that the offer says on its face that it was directed to Mr. Levy as counsel for Cedarbrook Mutual, and I don't know. I didn't bring my correspondence part of the file with me. Does me no good to tell you. I'll go home and check, obviously.
How about this, and I raise this with regard to this Town Realty versus Zurich case. Isn't there a distinction to be made in your case with regard to the duty to clarify? In the Town Realty case, that dealt with a duty, I'm saying isn't there, I'm not saying for sure, I really don't know the answer to this. In the Town Realty case, that dealt with a duty between a insurance company and its policyholder, arguably a fiduciary duty, a contractual relationship. Here, until Justice Babbage started raising this other area, as argued in your briefs, the duty is to a stranger plaintiff. And I think it's your position as to a stranger plaintiff, someone you have no contractual duty with, no policyholder relationship, that the burden's on the drafter to make it clear.
Exactly.
Is this a per se, let me ask, is this a per se rule that you're asking for? In other words, if it's ambiguous, a settlement offer is ambiguous, then regardless of whether the ambiguity is material, it's not a valid offer of settlement. Are you asking for that kind of per se rule?
Well, in my view, the ambiguity in this one is material because it goes to the very core of what the lawsuit's about.
Who's released? Your opposing counsel suggests that the law is that it has to be material to the ability to assess your liability to the plaintiff, not to a policyholder. Do you agree with his characterization of that statement of law?
Not in part. I do not agree that we could ignore a duty to a policyholder in our evaluation of his offer because that's not the case. That's not the case law. One other issue in this case that is a factor is that for a significant part of the time in question, there was a stay of the underlying action by the trial court until the coverage issue would be resolved. And no action was taken by either party with respect to the underlying action during the term of that stay because that was the court's order. That was the trial court's order. And in any event, if this court does decide to change or modify the rules regarding enforcement of offers of settlement, in this particular case, I do not think it would be appropriate to apply your new rules and hold Cedarbrook responsible for interest that would have accrued during the time that the trial court stayed the underlying action. And in general, I think that any new rule should be prospective so that all litigants who may be similarly situated to these are not caught in a situation where they thought they were handling these offers by the existing rules and now get hit with a decision in this case, which ineffectively, retroactively changes those rules. And
How much money are we talking about here?
Well, the offer was made in 93, and actually started in 93. Offer was in October of 93. The Cedarburg tendered its policy limits plus costs on appeal on November 30th, 95, 2 weeks after this court denied review of the coverage issue. I don't know if plaintiff is seeking interest even beyond the date of the tender, but you've got generally 2 years of interest on $100,000 at the statutory rate of 12%. So that sounds like $60,000.
When was the stay? What period was the stay at?
The stay was ordered by the court on August 22nd, 1994. And that stay would have been in effect till this court finally determined coverage on November 14th, 1995. So some 15 months that the action was stayed.
And your position is that at least, even if we were to give them interest from that period from August 22nd till November 14th, they are not entitled to interest.
That's correct, because neither party, there had been no discovery in underlying action. By the terms of the stay, nobody could do anything on the underlying case.
Mr. Doyle, if the court were to accept the suggestion of the Court of Appeals to require some sort of follow-up by the insurance company or clarification, what would be the policy downside of that?
I think you'd have a lot of these. I think you'd have your trial courts routinely hearing motions by one side or the other, probably by the defense, to resolve differences between plaintiffs and defendants as to whether an offer is clear enough yet or not. I don't think it's that tough under the existing statute and the existing case law to make an offer clear. You put in there exactly who you're releasing and the exact amount of money it will take to release it. It only has to be three lines long. We see a lot of these in routine litigation of personal injury cases, and rarely is there a question about what the offer means. That's those are the only remarks I have. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
I think the idea that an offeree that's confused about an offer should have some burden to clarify that is a great idea. Some of the issues raised by the courts are clearly I hadn't thought of before in regards to what about the poor insured here that has would like to get out under this offer. I think those are compelling reasons why there should be some sort of a clarification.
But what about in the case when insured isn't involved? It's just one party insurance company isn't involved. Are you then saying a defendant has, you want us to adopt a rule that says the defendant has an obligation to clarify the plaintiff, the one side has an obligation to clarify the offer of settlement of the other?
Yes.
Even when no insurance company is involved and no insurance involved,
right.
You want us to say that all
time? I think the answer to that is yes, and I was saying that I think that it's a good idea to have a clarification requirement. I was going to say but let me finish answering your question. First, if the offeree receives an offer, they have 10 days to accept it or not. If instead of having 10 days to accept it or not, they have 10 days to reply. We accept it, we don't. If we don't, state the reason why. If the reason is that you don't understand it, then you have the clarification requirement built in. If they fail to respond in any way within 10 days, they waive their right to contest the validity of the offer. It would be very simple. It wouldn't create motions or anything like that. It would be an easy way to administer that type of a requirement. However, in this particular case, I don't think that this should be be resolved on the clarification requirement. I think it should be resolved on the fact that the offer is not ambiguous. As I started with, and I would like to end with that, the offer, there are two attorneys, if there are two separate and distinct defendants, not insured and insured, but separate defendants, and we serve an offer to settle against one, and we name that defendant's attorney, and we say, we're going to dismiss this pending litigation, and your liability attendant to said litigation for this amount of money, there is no way that they could say, well, we're confused about who you're going to dismiss here, therefore it's ambiguous. That is almost the same case here. There were two attorneys. Mr. Doyle never saw this offer to settle because it wasn't addressed to his client, Luke. It was addressed to Cederberg and Ben Levy, their attorneys, only them. And there just is not an ambiguity.
How do they know that? That it's only been sent to one?
Because that's who it's addressed to.
That's in the record.
It says right on the offer to Cederberg Mutual Insurance Company and its attorneys, Ben Levy, Levy, Levy Associates. And then it goes on and states the offer.
What litigation was... Never mind. Sorry, counsel.
Back to briefly on the clarification requirement. If the court feels that would be appropriate, I do concur with the Court of Appeals that would be a good idea, and issues brought about by the court today, I think, make it even a better idea than what I initially thought it was. In terms of if they were to do that and apply it to this case, there is no reason why that could not be done, because this court has created new rules of law in the past. Gould v. American Family is one that springs to mind right away. And that was applying a new rule of law to a case which had up until it came to this court been proceeding under a different rule of law. So there is no reason why the court cannot do that. Furthermore, this case would be a good case to do that on because the equities and the facts are appropriate. Here, Cederberg, they never intended to accept this offer. They were going to litigate coverage from the very beginning. They never once raised any argument in the trial court when these 80701 issues were being decided in correspondence up until the Court of Appeals, second time was in the Court of Appeals on their cross appeal. That's the first time they said, this is ambiguous because we don't know who it offered to release. 5 years went by, they didn't say a single thing. If they were ambiguous as to who was released, they would have said that in the trial court when we addressed this. I see him out of time. So.
Thank you, counsel. I just want to advise both counsel that Robert Prosser is not in any way related to David Prosser. And Justice Prosser is sitting, and the opinion will show that in a note. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are in recess until 1:45.